Chris, thank you very much for, agreeing to talk to us this afternoon. It's really good to be speaking to you. So just to start off, just give us a few words about your coaching background. What sports and what levels of athlete do you work with?
Any and every level of athlete, primarily, and I suppose just organically, primarily I work with elite athletes. But I work with everyone from juniors right up to masters, like I've said to you. So I suppose my own coaching background is I raced and still race mountain bikes for the last, I think it might be 16 years now.
Cool.
Yeah, so since 1999 was my first mountain bike race, and I literally did not know one end of the mountain from the other, but it all worked out in the end. And then from there, I went to university and I did a diploma in sport and exercise studies. So it's a 2-year diploma, so another 2 years to get a degree, but I chose to go racing instead, because the degree course at the time would have been more business oriented, sports business as opposed to
Right.
science or physiology or anything of that sort. So I went off racing for numerous years, and I went back to coaching then in 2010, 2011, went to the UCI, the World Cycling Centre, just not too far from where I live in Switzerland, and did a 6 months kind of pretty intensive course there, and that's kind of set me up to where I am at this point, really. Yeah, so it's a big mixed bag of applied experience with a little bit of education.
Oh, excellent. I think you base yourself still in the in are you based in the Alps currently?
Smack bang in the middle of, well, not smack bang in the middle, but almost smack bang in the middle of the Alps. Yeah, so I'm in the French Alps, about 6 kilometers from the Swiss border.
All right. And do you have on many of the athletes that you coach, do you meet up with them physically, or is it nearly all distance coaching relationships?
It's all distance coaching relationships, but with a lot of face-to-face contact, if that makes sense. So I suppose the race season is so long for most of the guys I coach. You're looking at, April through to September, almost October now for some guys. So I coach primarily downhill and enduro, so the two kind of gravity disciplines in mountain biking. So I race the World Enduros myself, so I get to see all the guys I coach on the enduro side at the races at a minimum. If not, they come here or I go to them, or we cross paths kind of in different ways. And then the downhill guys, I attend every downhill World Cup with one of the teams I coach, which is FMD Racing.
Excellent, excellent. Does that involve a lot of travelling, both for yourself and the athletes?
Serious amount of traveling, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think 2014, I was working freelance for the UCI, and I was helping the Cycling Federation in St. Vincent's and the Grenadines develop a kind of a school cycling development program. So I think in 2014, I did 76 flights, I think, in total.
Wow, that is a
That
lot.
was an interesting one. It took a long time for it to catch up with me, but it eventually did, unkind of known to myself.
Yeah, interesting, interesting. So, Chris, when did you first experiment with heart rate variability, and what was it you were looking for at the time? Was there a problem you wanted to solve, or did you see an opportunity?
Yeah, opportunity only, really. I don't think I was looking to solve problems per se. I was, I suppose, looking more so to just improve processes. I think that was the main thing, to be honest. Improve processes, and because the sports I'm involved in are more towards the skill side than they are endurance, quantifying training loads and that kind of stuff is always a bit more difficult, because you don't have, we use zones and we use, different ways to judge intensity and to give intensity for training, but it is really difficult to quantify load because so much of the training is just sporadic,
Right, okay. And did you notice fairly quickly that training and lifestyle stresses, including perhaps travel, were getting reflected in HRV measures?
Yeah, travel instantly. Travel is just like bang, transatlantic flight. Or the first assay that I started using HRV with was a professional downhiller from New Zealand called Cam Cole, who's a good friend of mine, and I coached Cam for quite a few seasons. And he was interested in it, and it was a real mutual decision. And our partnership was also a coaching partnership. It was 50-50 almost. So he came to me with the idea, and I'd already toyed with the idea and done a lot of reading and he was more keen to implement HRV than I was almost, because at that time, I suppose it was before you guys, before I think started up fully, or you guys were just real fledgling iPhone only app, that kind of thing. And I was just, I suppose, not reluctant, but I was really researching as much as I could before I started implementing. He said, no, let's just do it and see what happens. And I was like, okay, might as well, you know. And we went from there, and yeah, pretty much he would have done a flight from New Zealand to Europe, and it would have just reflected instantly, like, you know, a 20-point drop on his score kind of thing the next morning, you know. So straight away I was like, right, it is sensitive to big stressors like travel or alcohol or those kind of things. So let's just see how it goes from here, you know.
Yeah, and I think sometimes people who are starting out using HRV as a measure, they expect it only to respond to training, and perhaps that reflects an assumption on their part that training is the only significant source of stress that's affecting their recovery. So, you know, have you seen a variety of responses in yourself and your athletes to training and lifestyle factors?
Massive. So some of the guys, myself included, it's with the iSleep Pro system, it's a bit easier now to see, get a clear indication of whether you're overactivated, underactivated, that kind of stuff, to what side of sympathetic or parasympathetic activation you're on. But yeah, for sure, I think for a lot of guys, myself included, it's lifestyle or external stressors or cumulative stressors, everything together, that makes the biggest difference. It's not just training. You know, when you get a certain, especially with the endurance-based training, you get a certain cumulative volume under your belt after years and years, and you can take a hammer pretty hard. What I always say to the guys is, you know, let's not fall off the cliff, because of what it's shown to us is you can just take volume, you know, especially if genetically you're gifted or you're predisposed to being able to take high training loads. You can just hammer yourself, or I can hammer them, and then all of a sudden you just drop off the cliff. Whereas you'll see little smaller fluctuations or even bigger fluctuations when sleep or food or numerous little small factors jump together and create something. You know, some guys will forget a recovery shake, not eat for 4 hours after a training session, stay in wet clothing, then, you know, go to a friend's birthday party. You get all these small lifestyle factors that kind of, or poor organization, that all come together, and before you know it, the next day it's just a write-off, you know.
Right. And when you say fall off the cliff, do you think that fits with the current model of progression of overreaching states? Would you say that falling off the cliff does that represent a transition from, let's say, functional or programmed overreaching through to non-functional overreaching, or do you see it differently?
Yeah, I think it'd be hard to say, give a definitive answer. Mm. Like everything in coaching and like everything in science, I think, or almost like everything, with the exception of a few principles, it's shades of gray. So I'm always super reluctant now to be black and white with anything. I take half a step back and always go, I'm not so sure. Let's learn more, you know. And that's kind of what led me to HRV in the first place. But yeah, it's like a turn point for sure. It's like a crux, or I don't know how to describe it best. I quite like visual descriptions and stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you do fall off the cliff, it's not for any reason. Whether it's I went too hard with prescribing training, or the athlete didn't manage their variables well enough, or whatever, environmental stress was quite high, or emotional stress or anything, if you do fall off that cliff, it's not the end of the world. It's so easy to pull yourself back. If you're, if we're mindful and we implement a couple of maybe key recovery strategies, or if we just reduce training loads, or just be clever, just don't be silly. However, if you do continue to push it, or, you know, an athlete kind of not hides a poor HRV score, but they're just going to go, yeah, whatever, or, you know, get a fall off the cliff and then don't take your reading for 3 or 4 days, so then we're kind of almost in the dark, you know. So then that's when things lead. I think overtraining in its truest sense is probably actually quite difficult to achieve unless you have massive amounts of time or serious levels of motivation. There's personality types that are far more susceptible to it, for sure, but that comes back to their inability to take stress, or their ability to create stressors in their own body, I suppose, is some way of looking at it. You know, some people are more susceptible to overtraining because of a personality type one than else, you know, and that's all interlinked into autonomic processes and everything else.
Yeah, I think it is. One of my sort of something I read a long time ago by Professor Stephen Porges, who has made some very significant contributions to understanding how the mind and body interact and develop some HRV measurement techniques himself quite a few years ago. He said that you can think about heart rate variability as an index of stress and vulnerability to stress. And the second one is a really interesting twist on that. So, you know, the implication is that the higher your baseline level of HRV, the more stress that you can take, you know, the higher physiological headroom you've got. And I quite like to use that nowadays as well as just the, you know, the sort of relationship between HRV and stress on a daily basis.
Yes, that's really interesting. I've seen that myself in my own scores and in other athletes' scores. And I've also had a guy who had consistently very, very high baseline scores, but was very susceptible to certain types of stress, I suppose we'd say. So lifestyle stressors and that sort of stuff never really seemed to affect him hugely. Or he's very good at managing that side of things. But certain training modes, certain training modalities would literally destroy him. And you'd see a 30 or 40 point drop in the ice peak score, with a certain type of session.
Yeah.
Whereas other guys can just absorb and absorb. So yeah, cool, interesting. And I've never read anything from that guy, so there you go. There's an avenue for more reading.
Yeah, he's good. Thought-provoking, at least. So you've used HRV and iFleet, in fact, for at least a couple of years. So, you know, you said you were looking for opportunities initially. Have your initial hopes been realised by using HRV? And what else have you learnt along the way?
I think, HRV is, I suppose it's like the self-fulfilling prophecy. Every time I use it now, it's kind of, every time I read a new bit of research, or try and apply maybe things I've read or learned, and I go back to past data, previous data for myself or athletes, straight away I'm like, oh yeah, that's kind of come true already. You know, now I see it, now that I know what I'm looking for, now I see it. Mm. And I think I've probably become quite sensitive at the time to know what I want to see or know what I'm looking for, if that makes sense to you.
Yeah.
So when we're actually within a training cycle, you know, especially off-season kind of, higher volume training or, you know, overall high load, then with the athletes I coach, because I know them all quite well now, I'm really acute and I can really see what I want to see very quickly, and I can I'll anticipate what I'm going to see and I'll almost always see it, which to me validates the system more than anything else.
Mm.
But with the iSpeed stuff, the biggest change for me was getting subjective scores onto something that's easy to see, and then being able to correlate subjective scores with more objective measures like HRV, and just be able to ask athletes, just go like, well, why is that so low in your subjective score?
Hmm.
You know, ask them kind of those leading questions and get a bit more buy-in from them and a bit more of an interesting insight into what's affecting them, you know, stress-wise in life and lifestyle. You know?
Yeah. I guess that's definitely right. What we see with users is probably reflects on them as well, the way people actually even use the subjective scores. Like, you know, we'll see some people whose personality type is, you know, they're really happy-go-lucky, nothing ever seems to upset them, and their subjective scores are all towards the right-hand side, you know. I mean, everything's either perfect or, you know, worst case, one notch off. And then you see other people who are like, you know, knocking down towards the other end, and then you see people who are just marking everything down the middle. And I think just even the way that they use the subjectives tells you something about their personality types.
Yeah, for sure. And that comes back to what we said about how personality is so interlinked to factors that are more than likely going to affect your baseline HRV or your ability to absorb stress and those kind of things. So, yeah, you get these kind of objective pictures of what who the person is. And I suppose if you're a good coach, you should be able to read people anyway. That's kind of 70 or 80% of what I do is people management, more so than physiology or science. Reading it's a relationship type thing. And yeah, you can kind of, I can just see, you can just, if you had all the HRV data in front of you, like with the iFleet Pro system, you can just kind of go, oh yeah, that person is that kind of person almost, you know.
Yeah, yeah. good stuff. So I think to many people who've used HRV for a few weeks, it's fairly obvious how they can use the daily traffic lights to, you know, moderate training or perhaps even take a necessary rest day. But as a professional coach yourself using HRV, how would you, you know, how do you use it within a periodized program, and what kind of things do you look out for during tapering towards important races and competition?
I suppose I have expected versus unexpected outcomes sometimes in terms of HRV monitoring, and I don't know, it may sound arrogant, but sometimes, or majority of the time, I know what I'm going to get because I know the athlete well enough, and planning is good enough that we almost know what we're going to get. And that's not me being this amazing coach. It's a 50-50 partnership. That sort of thing wouldn't happen with athletes who aren't very good at feedback, or I struggle to develop a good relationship with. Whereas athletes who I have a real good relationship with, and we do develop that partnership, the planning can be so precise and I can be so intricate because I know how they would respond to the load previously based off HRV and feedback and other things. So I'll have expected what I'll expect to see in the HRV kind of trends and day-to-day scoring. Especially with, I suppose, maybe what I'd call like a polarized scoring, and that's days I'd expect high HRV versus a low HRV score. They usually hold true, and if they don't, I maybe start to ask questions in terms of overall load, planning, those kind of things. Am I giving enough training? Am I giving too much intensity? Is the rest between two sessions or sets or reps at intervals enough? And those kind of things. So, yeah, there's lots to it. And like I said to you, when I'm in the midst of a training block with an athlete, then it's really easy to start to see trends and to start to see little bits and bobs that I want to pick up on, or things we can use to modify the next session or the next week's training, or even maybe cut a block short. You know, we've maxed out our ability to adapt to this kind of stressor. Yeah. You know, the blue line isn't climbing anymore, or we're stagnating and athlete's level of muscle soreness and motivation is dropping off. So whether it's physiological or not, it doesn't matter. If someone's motivation to train a particular mode or modality is dropping off, then it's time to take a break and refresh, those kind of things. You know.
Right.
And in terms of the taper, I suppose we're in an interesting sport in terms of having so many professionals that I coach, and our season being so long, in that tapering is almost a thing of the past. It's mini micro tapers, managing fitness and freshness to get form. You know, fitness plus freshness minus fatigue equals form. That's my formula. So using HRV to predict or to keep track of our ability to maintain freshness or increase freshness acutely before competition is kind of how I'm using it now, you know.
Mm. And what about the fitness element? We've seen some really quite nice papers from the research community about high correlations between improving HRV trends and base aerobic fitness. Would you go along with that, or would you say that you really need very carefully controlled conditions to see that, and is that something you actively try to develop?
Yeah, I depending on the individual circumstances, I have in the past still actively try and develop it, especially with the guys I coach who race enduro. So for anyone who doesn't know what enduro is, it's similar to rally in terms of format. You have time stages mainly going downhill, so technical, physically demanding trails anywhere from 4 to 15 minutes in length. And then you have to do your transitions or liaisons between each stage under your own pedal power with your bike. And the bikes are designed with a bias towards going down, not going up. So,
right.
Yeah, quite physically demanding. You have 1 to 2 days practice, 2 days racing. So aerobic capabilities across the full spectrum are super important, as well as metabolic flexibility, which is something we work on hugely in terms of your ability to burn your fat max ability, your ability to use fat as fuel to the highest point possible, and then be able to switch back and forth between carbohydrates and fat as well as you can. So for athletes who come to me who don't have a good aerobic base, training the full spectrum of aerobic fitness, like I say, and then watching HRV respond, you know, just sometimes it takes, it's almost like saturation, it takes a little bit of load for them to get wet for the sponge to soak it up, and then all of a sudden it just starts to climb and jump, which is really interesting to see, because it's for me, it's like, what is the minimum load before we get start to get return, and then at what point do we get diminishing returns, you know? So I've seen with the HRV scores in the past, just guys go from a low 50 in the ice feed system up to mid-high 80s over the space of 3 months, you know, and that's guys who just genuinely in the past just didn't train correctly, you know, for their given sport. So some just simple quality training volume and quality training modes, and before you know it, you're picked back, basically.
Right. You mentioned fat adaptation, and that's a, you know, it's currently a very popular topic. Would you go as far as recommending or even supervising athletes to become ketone adapted for professional races, or would you say that, you know, there are some training sessions that we should do in a partly carbohydrate starved state, but, you know, we should always race high, or, you know, how do you see that?
The general principle I always follow is that, yes, we do fasted state training. We definitely do carbohydrate restriction before, during, and seldom but possibly after training, definitely. Some intermittent fasting type things to promote fat adaptation and cellular signaling, most certainly for guys who need it on the enduro side of things, or guys who are bored, or get bored easily with higher volume training. I'm not a dietitian, so I'd be reluctant to go, okay, let's try keto, whereas it seems a lot of coaches buy into the keto or paleo or ketogenic diets or whatever sort of fashionable diet, or it's a restrictive diet is what it is. That's what I always call them. They're restrictive diets. They're not all-inclusive. So I'd be reluctant to recommend anything because I'm not a dietitian, which a lot of coaches don't seem to be worried about the fact that they're not dietitians or nutritionists. But no, we definitely don't, or I wouldn't recommend a ketogenic diet for the guys I coach, primarily because we're in high-intensity sports.
Yeah.
You know, extremely high-intensity sports. And travel across the globe, you know, huge travel schedules, very quickly changing travel schedules and that sort of thing. So sticking to ketogenic diets is quite difficult in those situations, you know, getting higher fat, you know, drinking olive oil. Drinking olive oil is your last resort. It's probably not what you want, you know. I have coached diabetic athletes in the past who have toyed with the idea, and they found the same thing. The only restriction that they had, or the only issue they had was sticking to it and staying in ketosis, staying in a ketogenic state, because just traveling was just so hard, you know, so hard to get food they needed.
Yeah.
So that was one of the bigger things. But yes, definitely we do quite a bit of fast state training and restricted carbohydrate training, for sure.
Okay.
No reason why not, you know.
No, indeed. And having a highly functional energy producing system that works on fat, it seems to me that, you know, that's what we were designed to do. You know, the hunter gatherers on the plains used to basically outrun their prey with long, slow distance, and then they do something very intensive at the end to either catch it or run away from it because it wasn't quite tired enough. So, you know, it seems to me that this polarized training and your body, you know, is adapted to providing those different energy sources under different circumstances.
Yeah, totally. Comes back to shades of grey for me again. There's no point in picking a fence post to stand on, really. I don't think so many guys are just so dogmatic about, oh, I'm high carb or I'm high fat or I'm somewhere in the middle and I'm happy to be in the middle. Because, you know, I suppose ancestrally, if it was summertime and the fields were full of fruits and berries, that's what you ate, you know. Simple as that. Yet your body adapted to it. Your body adapted to burn carbohydrates and different types of sugar as the primary substrate. If those weren't available, then something else was available. Your body just adapted and changed accordingly, you know. So that's why we have three or four main substrates to burn, because we need to adapt. So
yeah.
But now that science is helping us out slowly but surely in understanding how we can manipulate, I suppose, gene signaling and transcripting and all those sort of things, and just up to the coach to apply it smartly and not go too crazy. And luckily, we have stuff like ice leaves to maybe get a window into whether it's working or not, you know. So.
Yeah, that's interesting. I haven't actually tried it on myself as a quantified Simon experiment yet. I might do at some point, but I'm not sure if I've got the willpower. And I'm also, you know, wanting to train for events early next year, so I don't want to really mess that up either.
Yeah, I brought some guys back from It's like the end of the world from ketogenic diets. Guys who were on ketogenic diets from previous coaches that they had were primarily endurance coaches and didn't really understand the demands of some of the mountain bike events. They thought they understood, but they were stuck in their ways. They wanted all their athletes to be on a ketogenic diet regardless of discipline. So, you know, these particular athletes with the changed coaches started to use me as their coach, and we had to kind of regress or change back to a more traditional classic diet, you know. But we did see increases in peak powers and 5, 6, 10, 15, 30 second powers and power meters and stuff. So
yeah,
for me, we still tried to keep some of the, not obviously not the ketosis, but we still tried to keep some of the ability to use fat for a maximum amount of your time or at a maximum intensity level.
Okay, so do you see HRV as being used within the wider recreational athlete community as well as the elites? Is it a marginal gains thing, or do you think it has the potential to penetrate, you know, to substantial percentages of everybody who would run major marathons or even local 10K races? And if so, what do you see as the barriers to having that happen?
Interesting. Marginal gains is something I won't say it terrifies me, but I don't like the term. I dislike the term marginal gains for numerous reasons. But and I think something HRV monitoring and the iFeed system and everything else is definitely far more than marginal, because it's far more global than that. It's a far bigger window into what's happening at a very kind of primal, basic level within your body. You know, it's far bigger than marginal. That's for sure. Because in so many basic things and so many key lifestyle factors and stressors are all reflected in it. So it's definitely bigger than marginal. At the elite level, it's only going to get more interesting and better, I think, especially as there's probably an app war starting slowly but surely, I imagine, with you guys right in the middle of it. So things are just going to get better and better at the elite level. For the recreational athlete, I don't know really. I have used it with more recreational athletes, and having a coach on their side to help them understand and utilize the data is fantastic. So I'm not really sure about people who don't have a coach, or people who are helping themselves, I suppose, train smarter. So I need more personal experience with friends or family who are using it all on their own to answer your question better. But I think it's, yeah, guys like you with a very clear, simple, and effective app, you know, that sort of technology is very usable by everybody. There is other apps that I've seen that are considerably more complex, and I think you need to be more in my position to make the most of them.
Well, we're certainly trying to, you know, that was one of the starting points really for iFleet, was to make it usable on a number of levels, but on the simplest level, you know, just tell people, you know, help them understand their bodies a bit better, and, you know, give them either a green light to go do the training that's in the plan, or just whatever they feel like doing. You know, a lot of recreational athletes, you know, it's not their full-time occupation. You know, you should do what you feel like doing, provided your body's up to it and you'll enjoy it. But there are occasions when your body's not up to it, and you should know when those are.
Yeah, absolutely, for sure, yeah. And I think that's probably the key thing for the recreational athlete is in doing stuff they enjoy to a maximum, especially for the mountain bikers, and the kind of guys who, you know, keep up to date on my Facebook or Twitter feeds and those kind of things. And I think for the recreational mountain biker who trains a little bit for competition or just trains just to enjoy their sport, having something to give them a go-ahead to go and just absolutely hammer themselves is fantastic, because a lot of the time they just kind of don't know. And there's so much information out there, people just get confused. Oh, do I go do a long ride? Do I do intervals? Mm. Do I do CrossFit? Do I do yoga? What do I do? Whereas I think if you just kind of listen to your experience, enjoy your sport, and use something like HRV to give you a thumbs up or a thumbs down for high intensity, then it's just makes life easy, you know.
Right, that's brilliant. Well, thanks a lot, Chris, for sharing, you know, both your knowledge, experience, and your enthusiasm as well. We, you know, I really appreciate that, and be good to talk to you.
No problem. Any time, probably another 2 more years' time, and we'll have probably a completely different chat, maybe.
Well, maybe. I'll, thanks a lot, Chris.